This mortal coil.
Well, if you ever find yourself in Bendigo, you will definitely hear about and hopefully go and see the Great Stupa of Universal Compassion. The building is a Buddhist monument and it's been under construction for a while, but inside now sits something quite remarkable, a beautiful object that's made its way around the world for the last 10 years and has been seen by more than 11 million people. It's a 2.5-metre, 4-tonne jade statue of Buddha, and it's the largest of its kind in the Western world, carved from a single piece of jade, which is believed to be the largest ever found when uncovered in Canada 18 years ago. Just how this jade became the Buddha and how it landed in regional Victoria brings me to my guest for this Mortal Coil tonight, Ian Green. The stupa had the grand opening last weekend. 10,000 people were there, and Ian's here to tell us his story. Hello, welcome to the show, Ian.
Yeah, thanks. Good evening, Sarah.
Now, this is kind of the pinnacle of a journey, I suppose, that started for you back in the 1970s when you were working in advertising.
That's right. I was indeed. So, I mean, you know, it's one of those things from a very young child, I always kept asking myself, well, you know, what are we doing here? What's the whole point of it all? Why are some people doing pretty well and others people just seem to have one run of bad luck after the other? All these questions went around in my head, and I kept looking for answers but not really finding them. My parents said, you must go to Sunday school. And so I did that. And they said, when you get to 12, you can make up your own mind. So at the age of 12, I decided, that's it. Christians are all hypocrites. I'm out of here.
Wow.
Well, you know, 12-year-olds think they know everything.
Were your parents religious?
Not really. No, they weren't. But they thought, well, it's the proper thing that I should go and at least get a bit of a grounding in Christianity.
Mm. What was the hypocrisy that upset you as a 12-year-old?
Well, I could just see, you know, on Sunday people were talking about, being kind to all others and turning the other cheek and all that stuff. But then I'd see them during the week, and of course they were like normal beings, and they were exhibiting anger and grasping at things and everything else. So I thought, on Sunday you say one thing, but you know, for the other 6 days you do something completely different. So I think kids, you know, have a pretty high hypocrisy radar, so they tend to, you know, be unforgiving when they see things like that going on.
Mm-hmm. And then, so how many years later was it that you were working in advertising and your whole kind of idea about faith changed?
Well, you know, I kept trying to find different paths to faith, even like through my teens and then in 20s. I explored yoga and Hindu philosophy. At university, I studied Western philosophy. And then after university, I'd never, you know, by that stage been able to find something that made sense in my head and my heart, if you know what I mean. And after university, I then was lucky to find a career in advertising. And I sort of put the whole spirituality thing out of my mind for the time being, because advertising, we're talking the early, you know, 70s and so forth, was incredibly exciting, particularly for a boy from the country. And there were so many, very creative people and wonderful ideas going on, and lots of long lunches and beautiful women and, what's not to like.
Cocaine. But didn't you have lots of, you know, kind of cocaine parties in the industry at that time? It was a bit sort of Mad Men plus another decade on or something.
Yeah, maybe. to be honest, I didn't go there. But, you know, I did enough to realise that if I was going to keep going the way I was going to end up in a very young grave. And right. I would have left my life thinking at the end of it, thinking, well, what was that all about? You know, what was the point?
Mm-hmm. So you went to India.
I went to India and no specific plan in mind, but I just figured, well, look, you know, I'll try something different. So I went to India. Immediately when I got out of the plane and got into a taxi in India, I realised, oh, I could see, like on the taxi, there's a little shrine to, I don't know, Ganesh or Shiva or something, and there, every tree has got something, every shop has got got an altar or a shrine. And it just made me realise, like within a day of being in India, that this was the thing that was missing from my life, the thing I'd been searching for from my youth, but I never really found anything. And I tried to put it out of my mind, but really it kept coming back to haunt me.
And what was that, an everyday spirituality, a reflection of faith in the every moment?
Yeah, it was, but it made me realise that for me, the Australia that I'd left was incredibly materialistic, that spirituality was not really something to be discussed. It was almost something to be embarrassed about and hidden away. But I realised that, you know, materialism was not going to provide all the answers I needed. It was fun for a while, but was never going to provide the long-term answers. So I realised, yes, this is really the mission I've got to find out more about. But then, you know, I was surrounded by all these Hindu deities, you know, with elephant heads and monkey heads, Hanuman and so forth. So while I thought all that looked really funky, I didn't have the connection with it. So I didn't, again, find something that made sense in the heart and the head.
And Buddhism... Yeah, often for Westerners, Buddhism is that thing because it is very much goes with modern psychology. It's heart and head. Where did you come across the tenets of Buddhism? Was in India? Yeah,
it was. I didn't really know much about Buddhism. For some reason, it hadn't crossed my radar till then. But towards the end of my time in India, I just felt so overwhelmed by the noise and the dust and the heat and everything. I thought, I just got to get a space, a green space. I heard about this park nearby, and I went into the park, which was about 10 or 15 kilometres from where I was. And the moment I walked into this park, I had an overwhelming feeling of being at one with everything, like an intense feeling, and completely at peace with everything around me. Now, this wasn't any sort of wishy-washy, you know, feeling. It was actually incredibly empowering, but I'd never experienced anything like it before. And in front of me was this enormous big lump, big enormous thing, like 3-4 stories tall. I didn't know whether it was man-made, I couldn't tell whether it was natural, but it seemed to be exuding so much power, it almost knocked me over. And I just kept thinking, well, where am I, you know? What is this place? Why am I having this feeling I've never experienced before? So anyway, I looked around and I saw a sign. Oh, this is Sarnath or Deer Park, and this is the place the Buddha first taught. And so...
This is near Varanasi.
It is near... Well, that's where I was, in Varanasi, with all the burning bodies and all the heat and the noise and the smell and everything else. And so it was no wonder I just wanted to find some refuge.
And so what do you think was going on there? Do you think that you were a Buddhist in your last life and it was like a coming home or...?
Yep. That's exactly what I feel. So from a Buddhist perspective, and now it makes total sense to me, that, you know, being a Buddhist in my past life or past lives, by going to that holy, pilgrimage place, and Sarnath is one of the four main pilgrimage places in Buddhism, that was enough to rekindle that or connect up again with the Buddhist tendencies from the past. And, you know, when I was in that park, I bought a little book. It said, "What is Buddhism?" And I put it in my backpack. And when I got on the plane coming back to Australia, I started to read the book. And again, every page I turned, I kept saying, "Oh, I know all this stuff, but I'd never seen the words written down before." So it was exactly like that, just a completely reconnecting with something which had been so important to me in the past, but something that I'd lost or forgotten or whatever.
It was like a coming home, it sounds like.
Exactly the way I expressed it at the time. It was exactly like coming home, yeah.
Amazing. And so you got back, you were in Australia and you kept working in the advertising industry, but you joined a Buddhist centre in Melbourne, did you, to
Yes.
learn more about this kind of inner knowing you already had?
Yeah, well, it's just like, you know, the way these things happen. Like the day after I got back into Australia, I heard on the radio, oh, there's a Buddhist monk coming back. He's one of the first to be ordained in Nepal. He's coming back, he's a doctor, and he's going to be giving a public talk. So I went along to listen to him. Nick Rebush was his name. And I thought, oh, I've heard all this stuff, like I did with the book. I've heard all this stuff, but I've never actually heard anyone use these words before. So from that day, I really think the day I walked into that park, it completely changed my life. And I've definitely been, I've been a Buddhist ever since.
Right. And your dad had bought some land in Bendigo.
Yes, he
gave you 50 acres of land.
Yeah, well, as I became involved in the Buddhist Centre in Melbourne, I realised, and they were looking for a place in the country where they could set up something a bit more conducive to meditation and to retreat and so forth. And we tried a few places around Melbourne, but couldn't find anywhere exactly. Anyway, I was talking to my dad about it, and he said, well, why don't I offer you 50 acres of the land I've got here? It's only 15 or 20 minutes out of Bendigo, but it's a big stretch of bushland. So I said, okay, I'll offer it to Lama Yeshe. So I did. I actually wrote to him about it, and he checked by divination, not himself, but he asked, highly realized lamas or yogis or whoever they were, if he could check, if they could check and see whether this setting up a Buddhist center on this land would be beneficial or not. And it came back that it would be incredibly beneficial. So this was in 1980. And then Lama Yeshe came back and said, yes, this the land will be of great benefit to many sentient beings, and we should definitely go ahead with that, with a center there. And I will come there next year in August 1981, and I'll have the first course on the land. So that really meant we had to put a lot of things in place, because at this stage it was basically just bushland. And so we had to provide some basic infrastructure to be able to host a course with a very special lama with 200 people or whatever. So that's what we got.
That was the beginning.
Into. Yeah. Yes.
You're on Nightlife. We're talking to Ian Green, who has just presided over the grand opening of a very special Buddhist centre in Bendigo that began, as he said, from acres of bushland in the 80s on Nightlife. And so which sort of strand of Buddhism did you come to practice through this? It sounds like Tibetan Buddhism, was it?
Yes, it was Tibetan Buddhism, and it's the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism, which is the main school that the Dalai Lama practices, His Holiness the Dalai Lama practices, and so forth. And, it's just one of those things, again, where you've got a connection that I felt an immediate connection with these lamas, because, I could see that they were obviously very knowledgeable when you listen to them. They had an immense amount of training and knowledge, but on a personal level, they were just, full of laughter, completely approachable, very down to earth. They seemed to have tuned into the Western mentality. And I kept looking at Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa, his offsider, and thinking, gee, I don't know what they've got exactly, but I really want to get some of that as well.
That giggling happiness of the Tibetan monk that we see at the Dalai Lama.
Well, exactly the same as the Dalai Lama. I mean, they're just so down to earth, and that's what everyone, whether it's, the most senior politician he meets or the cleaning lady in the hotel, they all have the same feeling that, he treats me as if I was just his brother.
And why is that? Is that because they are living their beliefs, their principles, and the principles of Buddhism?
Yeah, exactly.
The noble path?
Well, it's the noble path, but it's also the practice of bodhicitta. And this is the practice of loving kindness, because basically one method we have for developing a heart of loving kindness is to realize our connection with all beings. And we say that all beings are our mothers. So we have connections with mothers in this lifetime, how precious that is. But in previous lifetimes, we've also had mothers, and in lifetimes before that, we've had a mother, etc., etc. So if we go on like that, we're actually connected to every being, theoretically, in the universe, really. And so, His Holiness expressed it in a very simple way. He said, whenever I meet any person for the first time, I always greet them as if I was greeting a long lost friend who I hadn't seen for many years.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a beautiful sentiment, and it's a reflection of all love and compassion and kindness. I mean, you mentioned the 12-year-old with Christianity seeing the hypocrisy, but there are also Buddhists who don't, you know, kind of walk around all happy and beautiful and laughing like the Tibetan lamas, aren't there?
I mean, oh, for sure, yeah, for sure.
There's violence at Buddhist countries, and
there is, and I mean, you know, I think Buddhism is a perfect path for me, but it doesn't mean all Buddhists are perfect, because I think, you know, we're all in many ways under the influence of the three poisons in our mind stream. This is what the Buddha explained, that, you know, at the root of it all is ignorance, but then on top of that we have attachment and grasping, and then we have aversion. So, and these all lead to self-cherishing and et cetera, et cetera. So while we're under the influence of these poisonous minds, we're all going to be, to some degree, looking after ourselves and not looking after others. So there's certainly people who don't practice Buddhism as well as they should.
Indeed. So you moved onto this land that your dad gave you, and you lived in an abandoned railway cart with no running water and no electricity. How was that?
Oh, that's right. Well, it was a challenge because we had three young boys as well.
Oh, my gosh.
And so, I mean, when I moved to Bendigo to set up this centre, I realised I couldn't do it by myself. So I asked a woman who I fancied and if she would come and join me. Now, she was, I mean, we were sort of dating, but we weren't a couple, like a firm couple at that stage. And she had three boys, the youngest of whom was about 3.5. And I know it's like a ridiculous thing for me to ask her to leave everything in Melbourne and come up here to Bendigo, bring your three children and live in an abandoned railway carriage without any water or electricity, and, you know, see by the light of a tilly lantern and so forth. And then I asked another fellow as well, who was someone I met in Nepal when I attended a course at Kopan Monastery. I had developed a connection with him. He was from Perth, and I said, I really want you both to come. And for some reason, they both agreed with that ridiculous proposal to come.
When did you have the plan of it becoming this great stupa?
Well, see, in August 19, originally we were just setting up a Buddhist centre. Mm. And then in August 1981, when Lama Yeshe came to the land, he did give a retreat there, as he said he would. But he also took myself and another fellow aside, and he then walked around this land and he said, "Now, here we'll have a big stupa." And he drew this enormous big stupa with a big temple inside it. And over there we'll have a hospice. And over here we'll have a lay village. And then over here, and we're walking, he described where the big stupa would be. Then we went walking further. He said, "This is where we'll have the monastery, and the monastery will start here." And then he's walking on and on and on and on.
And this became your mission. You were like, you'd been selected to do this.
Oh, absolutely. It was like something that I felt I had no choice. I was amazed at the time, because he was like walking around this site as if he'd studied, you know, topography and, you know, walked over it many times, because he could almost see it in his head, I think, the way he was describing it to me. So I thought, well, okay, if he can see this and he thinks it's very important to do, then I have no choice but to do my best to try and make it come to reality. So yeah, that was like the next 37 years I've been doing that.
Your life's work.
Yeah.
Ian Green's with me on Nightlife, and the Jade Buddha of Universal Peace is now inside this stupa, which is all, as this grand dream is still under construction. But you received a call in 2003 that basically set you on the path of the Jade Buddha.
Yes.
And who was that call from, and what happened?
Well, I was at home one night and I just had a call from a guy who said he was Cheyenne Sun Hill. And he spoke like one of the dudes from the movie. You know, he'd say, hey, man, we've got to make this Buddha.
Like from Great Lebowski or something.
exactly like this. I'm thinking almost someone's sending me up or something. But anyway, I listened to him and thinking, and he said, I've heard about this great stupa you're building in Australia and we must make this big Buddha. And I thought, I don't know, but anyway, something about him made me sort of interested, and it was, I don't use the word coincidence, but it seemed like you would think a coincidence, that I was going to Santa Cruz, which is where he was ringing from, only 3 weeks later. I was going to a meeting there. So I said, look, Cheyenne, I'll come to Santa Cruz and we'll talk further face-to-face, okay? And I couldn't really commit one way or another just on this phone call because, I mean, he said he'd tried to find many temples all over America to find it, and none of them were willing to take on this project of making a Buddha out of...
How did he have a giant piece of jade?
Well, he didn't own it, but he had two things that connected him to this boulder. One was that he was a Buddhist. The other one was that he was a jade jeweler who actually bought a lot of jade from this jade factory. Mm-hmm. So he was aware of this enormous boulder called Polar Pride, which they described as the find of the millennium, you know, the largest boulder found in 1,000 years sort of thing. And he was convinced that it must be made into a Buddha. And the miners were, you know, they had many offers to sell it to Chinese, to buy it, I mean, from Chinese companies who wanted to turn it into bangles or whatever. But the miners, to their credit, said, no, it must be a monumental piece. And again, they had many offers even for that. I mean, the city in British Columbia and Vancouver wanted to do something. But all these ideas fell through. And so 3 years after it was found, because it was found in the year 2000, it was still available.
Right. So you flew to Santa Fe.
Santa Cruz.
Santa Cruz, sorry.
And I met Cheyenne, and he said, okay, come into... So he took me out to a Mexican, you know, taco truck or something, and we had a little chat there, and then we went somewhere else and had a bit of a chat and sort of getting to know each other more and more and more. So after spending a whole day with him, I thought, look, this is either, I mean, potentially it's so enormous that I just have to follow it through. So I said, okay, Cheyenne, let's go to Canada and have a look at the boulder. So we did with it a couple of days later.
This is when you'd already got nude together?
Well, that's where we had most of our discussion. That's true.
What, in a nudist bar or something?
It's not a strip club. It was actually like he took me to a place. It had like a South Pacific sort of theme to it. He went in and he said, oh, take your clothes off, you know. And I said, oh, I got down to my, you know, my underpants. And he said, oh, no, take the whole lot out. That's what we do here. And then I said, oh, okay. And then I walked outside and, like, this whole big yard with palm trees and fake this and whatever. And, like, everyone is naked.
Okay. They're lying. You're stripped back to your human essence in this search.
Absolutely.
For this jade Buddha. Okay. So you were given – you went to Canada and you saw the boulder. What did you think when you saw it? And why is jade so important to Buddhism? Mm.
Well, jade, first of all, I mean, jade is not necessarily important to Buddhism, but it's definitely important to Asian culture, but also beyond that to actually all many traditional cultures where it actually naturally arises. So, for example, the Incan people in South America, or, of course, we know the Maoris in New Zealand. Wherever jade is present in these traditional cultures, it's revered as something precious, really to be kept for the elite. In China, it was known as the Stone of Heaven, and it was only for use within the imperial family. And there are many sort of features of jade which are quite unique. First of all, it's incredibly hard, but it also combines hardness with toughness. So like a diamond is a bit harder than jade, but if you hit it with a hammer, it'll shatter because it's not very tough. But jade combines both of these things. It's also got incredible density. So that means it holds its temperature, it holds its heat or coldness or whatever much, much longer than it would normally do just because of the density and the weight of it as well.
And tell us what that boulder now looks like, because it was carved in Thailand into a Buddha.
It was. So once we eventually obtained the rights to purchase this boulder, and we couldn't afford, you know, to pay for the whole lot, so we had to pay for it over a few years. We then, you know, arranged for it to go to Thailand because that was the place we decided where we would carve it. And that whole process was really quite incredible as well, because just as I'd never seen jade before, I'd never seen how you carve a gemstone before either. So I had to, you know, get up to speed very quickly with, well, how do you do it? What do you do? Who do you trust, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, a lot of the process in making a statue like this is getting a prototype to be exactly right down to the millimetre. And you start off with a small prototype, maybe like less than half a metre tall, get that roughly right, and then you go up and up and up in sizes. So right. By the time we did all these prototypes and started, eventually got the approval on that, got the carving, got the polishing, from the day I saw the boulder in Canada to when it was finished was 5 years. It took us an enormous 5-year period to actually complete the Buddha. So it was finished in 2008.
Right. And what's it look like? Because, you know, we don't really know what Buddha looked like, but is it a representation of Buddha the man who became, he was the founder of Buddhism, or?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you're right insofar as if you look at a Buddha carved in China, he will be, you know, very chubby-cheeked and have a big, nice round belly. If you look at a Buddha carved in Thailand, he'll be exactly the opposite. He'll have a very thin waist and he'll have very fine features as well. These are like cultural overloads which have been put onto the Buddha image. Mm. The feeling that many Buddhists have is that the Buddha in Bodh Gaya in India, in the Mahabodhi stupa, is the closest to the way the Buddha actually looked. Because the legend is that a woman realized, oh, I'm the last person alive who actually saw the Buddha alive. I must make a statue so that people can see what he actually looked like. So then she commissioned the creation of the Buddha, which still exists today in the Mahabodhi stupa in Bodh Gaya.
Where he sat under the Bodhi tree. And
that's where he became enlightened. That's right.
Okay.
And that's the Buddha. So we took many, many photos of that particular Buddha, took them off to Thailand to get the sculptor there, to actually design his prototype based on those photographs.
Right. But, I mean, the Buddha was not a god. He didn't want to be deified at all. There's not really a god in Buddhism. So why have a jade Buddha that then has travelled around the world, 11 million of people have seen it and is now sitting at the core of this stupa? What's it about? What is the Buddha there for?
The Buddha is there to remind us or to inspire us to what we can become. So you're right, the Buddha is not a god, he never said he was, and when we bow down in front of the Buddha statue, it's not bowing down in front of an icon or anything, it's actually bowing down in respect to the Buddha who actually showed us the path to achieve enlightenment, which is the perfection of wisdom and compassion. And the Buddha's liberating message was that, hey, I've done this, you can do it too.
And as you travelled around the world with it, because you travelled with the Buddha as it's done this you know, massive journey around the world, what sort of impact have you seen this statue have on people?
Yeah, well, I mean, as the tour went on, after a while, you know, the statue's always unveiled at the start of the opening ceremony. And after a while, instead of looking at the Buddha, I would turn around and sneakily look at the people watching it. And invariably what I'd see as soon as the Buddha was revealed, the faces would light up. You know, you could see the eyes open, the heart open as well. So I could see that this is a statue that truly inspires people to be more peaceful, to be, you know, as Lama Zopa said initially, to illuminate the world with peace. And I reckon that's what it's doing.
Right. And now it's in Bendigo. Yeah. What's the aim for, is it still on track to deliver what that vision that you had in 1980 when you were walking around that bushy area?
Yes, it is. Actually, we've the stupa itself is 60% complete, and we now have funding, which has been 50% of which has come from the Victorian government to complete the stupa, and that so complete the outside shape of the stupa, and that will be done by about this time next year.
The government's contributing.
Yes. Now, why have they done that? Not because Buddhists are nice people or anything else. It's because the stupa is already a tourist attraction. It's bringing jobs, it's bringing visitors to the region, and an investment by the government in the actual building and in the infrastructure will actually enable this to bring more visitors to regional Victoria.
And is your aim, do you want people to discover Buddhism and become Buddhist?
Not necessarily. If they want to, they can. But my main aim is this. Basically, the big picture is that we're about making the world a more peaceful and a more compassionate place. Now, by people coming to the stupa, by people seeing, by people listening to a radio interview about the stupa, what they're going to do is hopefully have a similar realization to what I did, you know, way back in 1970 or whatever, that, you know, spirituality is an important part of our life, and to accept that. Now, whether it happens to be Buddhist or whether it happens to be, you know, Mormon or whatever is your thing is entirely up to you. But I really want people to come there and to recognize the importance of peace, compassion, and spirituality in their lives.
I guess a lot of people may be thinking, though, but that all that money that goes into a, you know, beautiful, wondrous statue and the stupa, could that be better spent helping people who suffer and struggle in other ways? I mean, it is a question people may ask of this.
They may, yeah. Well, that's exactly what we're doing. We are helping people who are struggling, because to me, spiritual wealth and health and well-being is as important as physical health and well-being. And, you know, like we can easily see the government will spend, you know, $48 million on a memorial to Captain Cook in Sydney Harbour. So you see that, you know, even in a, you know, historical or political sense, these sort of things have power. They have power because people, their mind is influenced by them. And at the moment, if you go around Australia, you'll see big images that are associated with, you know, sport and competition, or associated with commerce, or they're associated with retailing. You know, so you think of big shopping malls or office blocks or you know, the MCG or whatever. But what we're about is saying, hey, don't forget spirituality. That's just as important. And, you know, if we're going to really make that sort of statement, we have to do something big and impressive and imposing as well.
I mean, you said at the beginning of this, when you went to India, it was also familiar and you felt, I know this stuff, I've got this stuff. You were Buddhist in your last life. Mm. This is your life work now. Do you think that your next life you'll be a Buddhist? Will you achieve, I don't know, what's it called when enlightenment and not have to be reincarnated? Is this good penance for you, or good karma, I suppose?
Well, I don't know. I have no idea what's going to happen with my next life.
Do you think about that?
Oh, look, I do. As a Buddhist, you always think about the impact of your actions and body, speech and mind, the impact you're having on others, because that is indeed creating, you know, the karma for your future rebirth as well. So, I, you know, you try and do the best you can without being, you know, too strict or too severe about it. I'm just trying to make the most of my life, I suppose, that make my life as meaningful as I possibly can. And hopefully that will have, you know, some positive karmic benefits for me in the long run as well.
Mm. So the Buddha is now, is the Buddha home, and will he leave again, or will he stay in Bendigo, this statue?
Well, I promise the Buddha will stay here for 4 to 5 years, but we have people already pleading from USA and Canada, Malaysia, Vietnam, and some other countries as well. I can't remember at the moment.
Right.
Please bring the Jade Buddha back. And so I've said, look, not for 4 years, maybe in 5 years' time. So I figure that he's having a bit of a rest after travelling the world and now really establishing the great stupa in Bendigo. And then maybe after 4 or 5 years, we have designed the stupa so it's just big enough by about 3 centimetres to get the Jade Buddha out of the front door again.
No room for error there.
No room for error, I know. I have my heart in my mouth at every time. But, you know, he's a warrior for peace. That's the way I look upon him. So we've had a few risky things happen as he's travelled the world, but generally he's survived. Maybe a scar here or there, but he's got a job to do. That's wow. More important than the way he looks.
Well, if people want to see, he's 2.5 metres high, mm-hmm. 4 tonnes jade statue of Buddha, the largest of his kind in the Western world, carved from a single piece of jade at the centre in Bendigo, regional Victoria. And I'm coming for the Writers' Festival, so I'm going to come and have a look later in the
Fantastic.
Year.
Fantastic. I look forward to meeting you then.
Yeah. Thank you so much for chatting to me, Ian.
Yeah, thank you very much as well.
You're with Sarah McDonald on ABC Radio.